Seems funny to have a bottle of water down there. I'm Tom Belts. I'm an alcoholic. And my goodness, what an aha moment this is. This is a lot of people. Thanks, Randy and the committee for inviting my wife and I to come and speak tonight. It's an honor to do anything we can for Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to welcome the eight newcomers that raised their hand tonight. I hope that you guys keep coming back, and this is a place for you. This is where you should be. Congratulations, Steve, on 90 days, and to Mike, Dave, and Stephen on your birthdays, and to the visitors from L.A. Glad that you're all here. My sobriety date is April 19th, 1985, and for that I'm very, very grateful. A little background on where I come from. I was born in 1942 in St. Paul, Minnesota, in the Midwest, and into a fairly small family, dad, mom, and a sister and I. And I guess I was kind of hoping for one of those Leave It to Beaver or one of those type of families, but it wasn't meant to be. It was anything but. It was a very dysfunctional family. My dad was a massive alcoholic. He died at the age of 54. A lot of men seem to die in their 50s if they be massive alcoholics. He was a cross-country trucker, and he was gone a lot. Many times I was grateful because he was very violent. He was very abusive, physically, mentally, emotionally, and whatever. I seemed to be the prime candidate to take most of the abuse. My sister seemed to fare much better than I did. I was a sickly kid too. I had sinus real bad, so I was like a pincushion, getting shots all the time. Wintertime, my sister and all of our friends would be outside playing and skating in the backyard, and I'd be inside looking out the window at all the fun they were having. So I was miserable from not feeling well and not being able to join them, and I was also sore and beat up from the abuse from my dad. So it wasn't a real good beginning. I had very low self-esteem, very little self-confidence, and that's not a good way, I guess, from what I hear, to start your life. But those were the cards I was dealt, and that was the hand that I had to play. I learned to be a survivor. My mom and my sister also learned to be survivors, do anything that we could to stay out of Dad's way when he was on a rage, and unfortunately that was quite often. Because of my health, they did move the family out to San Diego. The doctor said either Southern California or Arizona, so we wound up in a little place, part of El Cajon, called Bostonia. And 1952, and we've been in the San Diego area ever since. So I am grateful to my dad for at least bringing us out here. My dad died when I was 17 years old. He was 54. He had been hospitalized at Paradise Valley Hospital here in San Diego for two solid years before his death. Back in those days, they could keep you in hospitals. They don't do that anymore, but they did back then. And so my mom would come home from work, and my sister and I would take our homework, and we'd all go down to the hospital and smuggle some food in to him because it was a Seventh-day Adventist hospital, so there was no meat or anything. So we would smuggle it in to the nurses And I really hated my dad, but I would spend a couple minutes in the room, and then we would go down to the lobby, and we would do our homework, and then start the drill one more time. You know, we did it over and over and over again for 2 years. The final day before he died, we were all so sick and worn out that we couldn't go. We had some friends go, and wouldn't you know, the following day he died. I really had a lot of anger behind him and what had happened in our home. But as a result of this program and getting into the steps and trying to figure out how I could make amends to this man, You know, because I had a hard time. I thought he had done everything to me, but what I had done to him was character assassination, and I had chewed him up and spit him out about every way you can. And I went to a movie one time, and I didn't know how to do it. Sponsor said, well, you might write a letter and burn it. Well, that sounded, I'm a college graduate, that sounded pretty hokey. And so I wasn't going to do that, and I never went to movies, and I just decided to go to a movie one time. I had no idea what I was going to see, and I saw this movie called The Field of Dreams. And if you haven't seen it, it's a movie for dysfunctional families, especially father-son issues. And it was like the faucet opened up, and I just almost everybody in the movie place started crying, and I was right amongst them. And it was one of those deals where I didn't want to turn it off. I mean, it was just very, very therapeutic for me. I remember driving home and getting home and calling my friend then, this wonderful woman in front of me, and telling her, don't worry about me, these are tears of joy, you know, and something incredible is happening. And I suddenly realized that my dad never got that manual from his dad or that guidebook on how to raise kids or how to... I never remembered him ever telling me that he loved me. We never had those father-son talks that I would have died to have. But I came to peace at that moment that he had done the best he could, you know, with what he had to deal with. And I believe to this day that on the other side, and I'm not rushing it, believe me, by any means, that we're probably going to be able to play catch and we're going to be able to have some good talks. You know, I really believe that today. So thank God for this program that some incredible changes can happen in our lives. It certainly has for me. After my dad died, I became extremely judgmental. I had to grow up fast. I had to become the man in the house and do the best I could to help my mom. And I put a lot of pressure on people my own age, my friends. You know, why aren't you as responsible as I am, you know, and able to deal with things? Well, why should they be if they're not in my circumstances? And they weren't in my circumstances, you know, but... And lo and behold, I come into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and I find out that the first character defect that I can put a label on is being judgmental. Isn't that something, you know? And it's the first one that I can remember, judging others. And I've had to work a lot on that. In high school and college, I never really drank much, a little bit here and there. I went to Hoover High and then San Diego State University. I started there in 1960. And graduated in 1965. I was on the 5-year plan, and I wasn't in any fraternities, so there wasn't that massive push to drink and drug and everything else that's out there, I guess. And I think too, part of the problem with not getting into alcohol and drugs at a young age or at high school or college is that the memories of my dad were still too fresh. You know, I had sworn up and down, like I'm sure a lot of us in this room have sworn up and down, I never want to be like him. I'm never going to be an alcoholic like my dad. You know, so the scars and everything else were too fresh, and it kept me from really getting into the disease at a younger age. So I guess there's something good about that. But at age 20, I was getting rebellious at home, you know, my mom didn't have all the answers, and I guess I did. And I, you know, just popped off once or twice too often. And she did the old-fashioned thing, and I don't hear about it much anymore. And maybe it's something that ought to be tried more often because it worked with me. She packed a suitcase, and she put it on the front porch, and she says, there's your stuff. See ya. You know, and she meant it. And then she followed that up with, you know, by the way, don't bring your dirty drawers back here and expect me to wash them. And, you know, I never did bring my dirty drawers or anything else back and either wash them there or have her wash them. So I think that she was teaching me a lesson that I needed to grow up and I would be able to grow up. I'd be able to make it. And it was the beginning of me, you know, getting on my own 2 feet. I had a lot of roommates, as I'm sure a lot of us in here have had over the years, and some of them were very good and some of them were absolutely horrible. And there again, they weren't responsible like I was, you know. They didn't pay their bills and we had bill collectors calling and knocking and and harassing and everything else. So, and that's when my drinking really started to take off, because all of a sudden I was around a bunch of people that liked to party, and I wasn't around Mom, and I wouldn't be embarrassing her. And so there was a lot of parties, and there was a lot of drinking that started to happen then. And not enough to where it really, you know, got me kicked out of school or lose a summer job or anything like that, but I was on the way. And 1965, I graduated from San Diego State with a pre-law degree. My first 2 years were my best grades, and then I started to, my grades started to slip because I wanted to get out there and make the money. I always had summer jobs. I never had to go to summer school. And I always was out there making money. And in those days, I was making pretty good money for summer jobs. And I could just see that green, you know. And I loved the freedom that the money brought. And so I had real questions about going on to law school. I thought there was a good chance I would flunk out or I would wash out. And then that would all be wasted time and effort. And so that particular time, I had a summer job. This was a great job. I used to work on the old Coronado ferry boats as a deckhand for several years. And one of the quartermasters was taking court reporting. And he was up in the wheelhouse, and at lunchtime, he would have his machine out practicing, and I would go up there, and I'd have lunch with him. And I was very intrigued by this machine. And he got me involved, interested in going to school. I went and I signed up, and I started court reporting school, and got into that about 2 years into it, and was doing really well. My speed was, it seemed like it was something that was meant for me. I seemed to acquire the skill and the talent pretty easily, and so I started that when I was 22. At age 24, however, a really, really devastating thing happened to me. I got the infamous greetings letter from Uncle Sam, and they wanted me into the United States Army. And I had just heard before that they were going after the 19-year-olds, and I thought, maybe I've made it, you know. And I'm looking at this letter, and it said, greetings, colon, and they told me where to show up for a physical. And I guess I didn't say or do or show symptoms that would get me kicked out. And so they sent me up to Fort Ord, where I went to lovely Monterey, which is a real hellhole if you have to go to basic training. And that's where I went through basic training and had a hard time there, but didn't want to get recycled and go through the whole thing again. So somehow made it through found my way to Fort Huachuca in the lovely desert of Arizona, and we'd hitchhike into Tucson or Phoenix and get all the drinks that we wanted. We had a good time at Fort Huachuca, and those ranchers would always pick us up. There was no problem at all, and they would pick us up if we were drunk too. It didn't matter. Then I went on to Fort Gordon, Georgia. I got a little of that southern exposure, and that was pretty startling back in those days. It startled me. And when I finished the school in Fort Gordon, I got another set of bad news. I got orders for Vietnam, my buddy and I. And everybody else in our class got orders for Korea. And you could imagine that because I'd been following what was going on in Vietnam at the time, so I went into a depression. I had a long bus ride from Georgia back to San Diego for 2 weeks leave, I had all these negative thoughts and really nothing positive and nothing good, and a lot of depression. And I remember getting back, and people were throwing parties for me, and I was drinking a lot and eating a lot and getting crazy and out of shape. Finally the time came, and I flew out of Travis Air Force Base on a big TWA jet headed for Vietnam. And on that plane were about 250-300 other young men going off to a destination unknown. We landed there, And I'll never forget, back in those days, pilots never stayed on the ground any more time than they absolutely had to because they were being shot at on a regular basis. And I'll never forget, it's a mark that's indelibly stamped or whatever into my psyche. The senior pilot on that jet came out of the cockpit, and he came back to us, and he got on the microphone, and he said, "I want to wish all of you guys the very best of luck for the coming year, and I hope to bring you all back in a year." And, you know, he didn't have to do that. You know, he didn't have to take those precious seconds or whatever to wish us well. And he knew, and all of us knew, that everybody on that plane was not going to come back. And, you know, but it's that was a moment that I will never forget. And I just thought it was incredible compassion on the part of an individual. After processing, I was sent to the 1st Infantry Division, the Big Red One. And we were stationed at Lai K, 40 miles north of Saigon. And I'll tell you what, that was a horrible year that I spent there. Back in those days, we went one person at a time to a unit and replaced one person. So it was very isolating and very lonely. It's not like now where kind of units are go over and units come back the best they can. It was just a single person for the most part. So I can remember going up to Lai K just myself, replacing one lucky person, getting to come home. And, you know, that base turned out to be not a very good place. It was ranked second to the big Marine base at Khe Sanh. The most outgoing and incoming mortars and rockets came into our place. And we spent a lot of time in bunkers and, you know, running to try and get to a bunker, just enough time to get on the ground. You know, I saw a lot of things and did a lot of things that nobody should have to see or do. It was the Tet Offensive. It was probably the worst year of the war, 1968. I was there the entire year of 1968. And I want to thank anybody that's a veteran for your service, whether it's past or present. I appreciate it. I wrote home after 2.5 months over there to my mom and my sister, and I said, you know, there's only two ways I'm coming home. That's dead or seriously wounded, and that's exactly how I felt. The morale was about a negative double Z. There was, you know, Jane Fonda was acting up, and there was a lot of stuff going on then. And I had her all diced up nicely, too, at a number of points over the years. But, you know, and the saving grace for me really was that on occasion we could get liquor. And when I could over there, I would drink as much as I could just to pass out because we couldn't sleep. There was so much noise, so much stuff going on all the time. And we were always on the alert. And so that was really kind of the beginning of my alcoholism. And I was actually at that point very grateful for it because it was like something that was just going to knock the hell out of me and allow me to sleep. So after that first full year in 1968, I came home. I was not physically injured. And I came home, and like a lot of veterans, certainly in Vietnam, I came home and told people that I was fine. I was absolutely fine. And you know what? I don't use that. If anybody hears me use the word fine, tell me, because I think it's a cop-out for me. I never use that word anymore. There are a lot of wonderful words to use besides fine, but to me it's a cop-out. I found out later several times that I wasn't fine, and I had a lot of problems. And Alcoholics Anonymous allowed me to address those problems, for which I'm very grateful. You know, I'll never forget when I came back alone one more time to Lindbergh Field when I'd been processed out. And that feeling while I was waiting for my stepdad and my mom to pick me up was one of total loneliness, total feeling of being alone, feeling unappreciated. And like all of us felt that we were backing into our own country. Here I am, a United States citizen. I put my life on the line for the country. And I come back, and because it was such an unpopular deal, you know, we faced a lot of issues when we came back home. Friends of mine were spit upon. I had to answer questions from very good friends about why I did what I did, why I went, why I didn't take off, and all these things, you know. And it was not a fun time at all. Not everybody, certainly, that was in Vietnam, but many of them came home. And we began to suffer from drug abuse and alcoholism, committing domestic violence, massive divorce, massive unhappiness, suicide, homicide, everything you can imagine. And at that time, there was really no help available. And so I guess because of our problems and the issues that we faced, we were a lot, you know, we kind of got some programs and some therapies and some veterans programs in place for veterans, you know, coming down the pike. And for that, I am grateful because I've used those benefits myself. After a little bit of time trying to get myself back together, and of course I was fine, so I shouldn't have even taken, you know, a couple weeks. I went back to court reporting school, and I got back into the high-speed class, and I used the GI Bill, and I'm very grateful to have been able to use that because I didn't have much money. I wasn't wealthy by any means. And so I was able to finish that course. In 1971, I was hired by the Municipal Court of San Diego County as a court reporter. March 15th, Ides of March of 1971. And I'll never forget my soon-to-be boss. He called me at 10, and this is so neat. I mean, he called me at 10 o'clock at night, and he offered me a job. You know, would you like a job with us? And the only problem was he was drunk. And, you know, and here I was, a rising star alcoholic myself, you know, and this guy is offering me my job drunk. And so I had to think quickly. I had just a few brain cells left. And, you know, I asked him if I could get back to him in the morning and let him know if I, you know, would be able to take the job. Because I wanted to see if he, you know, if he had remembered offering me the job when he was sober. And so I called back the next day, and lo and behold, he did say that he had offered me the job, and I took it. And that was the beginning, really, of a 34-year career that I retired from 6 years ago, six-plus years, which is an absolute miracle that I was able to retire from the county and have a pension and have the life that I have today. Those first 14 years of my work was in active alcoholism. I used to have the shakes in the morning. It's a very responsible job. I mean, defendants' lives are on the line. Most of my reporting was criminal. And, you know, you can't screw up these transcripts. And, you know, people's lives are on the line. And fortunately, I never had a transcript questioned. And that's an act of God. That's God's grace that I didn't lose that job in that position. But I would also sweat so much, and I had this massive problem. You know, I guess alcoholics, you know, that happens to us. And I sweat so much that I had to have women's shields sewn in all my business suits because the sweat would just pour through the arms, you know. But I was an alcoholic really, really on the rise and shine, you know. And you know how we rationalize and justify everything that we do or think or whatever. And I thought, you know, this is really good to be able to sweat and get all that poison out of your system so you can drink more. And, you know, so it didn't matter whether there was, you know, all this sweat flowing or whatever. You know, I just went about my business and nothing bothered me. You know, I did my job and I guess I did it okay. And another great thing for me was there was a bar right across from the courthouse. And it was called The Gavel. And, you know, I loved that bar. I was a lover of bars. And I went through, I don't know how many bartenders through the years, and I really got to know them well, and I would always pay my bill first ahead of everything else. And you know how it goes when they just pour and they don't measure. That is so wonderful. I mean, I can almost taste it, you know. And I used to love the lies. I mean, the lies and the one-upsmanship. You know, you always got to outdo the next guy with, you know, he was some incredible person with some incredible profession or whatever. And, oh, yeah, I did that and one more, you know. And we're all lying and we're all getting caught occasionally in our lies and all that good stuff. And I can't forget the greasy hors d'oeuvres, you know. That was my dinner many a night, were the greasy hors d'oeuvres in the bar, and I loved them. They were free, you know. They were free, and wow. And I mean, I was spending enough on the booze. I should be able to get some free food. It wasn't quite food, but the best part were the smells. I used to love the stale cigarette smells, the stale beer smells. I used to love the smells in the head. I mean, it's just because I spent so much time, you know, on my knees around that porcelain throne. You know, I just had an affinity for it. I still to this day, you go into a restroom and some people get so upset with the smells. And it's no big deal, you know. So I would wait a little while for the traffic to die down, and then I would drive home very carefully, you understand, you know, slow, and watching the line, trying to get a, because I had already had quite a few, and trying to get that eye, you know, on the line and try and steer it pretty good. I never did get arrested for drunk driving or anything, but I would get the car home, and I drove in blackouts virtually every time I drove. And I didn't understand what a blackout was until I got into Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I thought you had to be totally unconscious, you know. And I'd get that car in the driveway, and then I'd take that trip around the car. Any of you done that? I used to have problems with curbs, and I would kind of bounce off them once in a while and lose a hubcap once in a while. So I'd check any hubcaps missing, any new dents in the car, and God forbid any blood on the car. Because I to this day, I don't know what I would have done if I would have found blood. Because I have a hunch it would not have been the end of my drinking, which is very scary. Then I would have had the paranoia of waiting for some authority to come knocking on the door or whatever to deal with that. I couldn't get to sleep. You know, I would come home and I would continue drinking until I would, like, pass out or flop on the bed. Then I had this phenomenon of whirling dervishes and the spins that would take over, and so I couldn't sleep, and I'd try one foot on the floor and all these other home remedies, you know, to be able not to have that damn spinning, you know, and that's when I'd have to get up, and the bathroom was real handy, and I'd be on my knees around the porcelain throne one more night, throwing up, and then I would somehow get to my feet, and this is a beaut, man, to stand up and look in the mirror and to see that pitiful human being looking back at me, you know, those bloodshot eyes, those roadmap eyes, and then the headache would start, you know, the hangover was on, and then I would do, I don't know how many thousands of times I did the alcoholic prayer, you know. God, get me out of this one. I'll never do it again. And, you know, that wouldn't last for very long. And then a day or two at the most, and I'd be back drinking with those other people who had very similar things going on in their life. I drank alcoholically for 17 years, and it was a downhill slide. I didn't get involved in anything else other than alcohol. And I used to be very judgmental of those drug addicts, you know. I mean, what a bunch of lowlifes, you know. And here I am abusing the biggest drug of all, alcohol, you know. So there's the judgment again. See, it creeps in virtually all the time with me. So I've had to do a lot of work behind that. Toward the end of my drinking, I became very paranoid because I worked in the court system and I knew what went on behind drugs and alcohol. And I would see defendants come and go and get sentenced to county jail or to state prison and get back out and pick up some new charges, and they'd come back, and especially the drug addicts, they'd look much more dead each time I'd see them. And the alcoholics didn't look real good either. But you know, I still couldn't bridge the gap between my dad being a massive alcoholic and maybe I ought to look at the fact that I could be the same thing. I couldn't bridge that gap yet. And so it still wasn't enough to, I hadn't been arrested yet. I hadn't injured or killed myself or someone else on the freeway. And I'd seen what happened to those people, including defense attorneys, judges, district attorneys who, first time out of the chute, maybe never been arrested for drunk driving and kill someone on the freeway. And there's no county jail, there's no probation, it's right off to state prison. And you got on one side the defendant's family, on the other side the victim's family, and there's no winners anywhere in sight, there's no winners. So I didn't understand the concept of the yets, but I was so paranoid, I knew that I was going to kill someone. It was going to happen quick, soon. So what happened to change all this mess was April 18th, 1985. I went on a men's church retreat. Now, this was a beautiful thing. I was going to a church, but didn't know really much of anything about what the church stood for or anything else. Didn't know the guys, and didn't know what was going to happen, but I knew I wanted to drink. And I knew I wouldn't be able to drink, probably, on this men's church retreat. So I was ticked off because I had to work late that day. It seems like every time you have something to do, you have to work late, and you get home late. I didn't catch the church bus, so I thought, well, I better start drinking. And I love the hard liquor. I love bourbon, and that was really, I'd drink anything I could, it was around, but if I get the hard stuff, I'd drink it. I drank that, and bourbon and water, like Kool-Aid, and here again, that wonderful, wonderful alcoholic thinking, rationalizing, justifying that if I pour down as many as I can, it's going to last me through the weekend. Unfortunately, it didn't last me through the weekend, and I'm glad, because the next morning it was pretty much over. I was terrified of these guys, really, because these were the men of the church. These guys were right to the right hand of God, I just knew that. And I knew they had no living problems, and I knew they were perfect. And then we broke up into these small groups with four guys to a group. I have no idea what the topic of the weekend was, but they started to share, and it turned out that two of the four of us in our group were members of 12-step programs. One was in Alcoholics Anonymous, these church guys. And I thought, I didn't know at that time, but they started to share. One of them was talking about their marriage going south, and another one, their kids were on drugs. And I'm paranoid, and it's coming around to me. I'm next. And I wanted the heat off of me real quick so that fourth guy could talk. This was probably the biggest spiritual thing that ever happened to me, certainly up to that point. I said something, and you can use drugs or you can use alcohol in this statement. I said one sentence. I said, "I think I have a drinking problem." And this guy, and listen up, newcomers, this guy that was in AA, he said, "Tom, if you think you have a drinking problem, you have a drinking problem." And something happened, like somebody took a 2x4 and stood back and swung it as hard as they could and clocked me between the eyes. Because immediately I knew that the ball game, the way I was playing, it was over. The way I was living my life was over. I just didn't know what to do. I knew that I couldn't continue because I was going to die. All of a sudden, I made that bridge between my dad and my predicament. But what do I do now? And this guy took me on that Monday after the weekend. He was a businessman, thank God, because we had a very long lunch. I had a lot of questions. I'm a very inquisitive guy, and I ask a lot of questions. And I tried to ask the questions that would prove that I was not an alcoholic. And he was very patient, and he just would continue doing his deal, trying to help me. So where am I here? He asked me if I would go to a meeting that night. And I said, well, yeah, I suppose I should. And he took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was April 19th of 1985. And it's still my home group over 24 years later. And for that, I'm very, very grateful, you know, that that he took me there and God helped take me there. And this man was the angel kind of stepping in and doing the work, taking the action for me. And I was the only newcomer at that meeting. And I hope I never forget, you know, I looked at the ground. I would not make eye contact with any of you people because... you know, I just knew that you knew me and you were going to broadcast all over town that I was an alcoholic. And then the leader made the big mistake, as we often do in meetings. We want to hear from the newcomer. And I think what he wanted to hear was some newcomer wisdom. And there's a lot of newcomer wisdom. You know, we always think we have some good stuff to say. And so he called on me and I had this all figured out. And these people in here had long-term sobriety. They really did. They'd been around a long time, I came to find out. And I said, you know, I really feel sorry for you people because you seem to be so sick. Not that I'm sick, but... And they all did what you're doing. They started to laugh. Well, I'm paranoid, okay? And if you're paranoid, you don't take kindly to people laughing at you, you know? And their heads were all going up and down because they understood that I was in such massive denial. I didn't know, you know, one wall that I was bouncing off from another. And the first cliche or saying that I ever heard in Alcoholics Anonymous is keep coming back. That's what they told me. Keep coming back. It's a precious saying that I use today. And the other one that really is a big one is one day at a time. And for many of us, it's one day at a time or less. You know, but I found out shortly after that that what they were doing when they were laughing, and there's a huge difference, folks, is they were not laughing at me, they were laughing with me. And there's a huge difference between those two things. We can laugh with each other in this program, you know, and we're supporting each other, we're loving each other, we're caring about each other. You know, we're not poking fun at each other, but if you're paranoid, you have no clue. And... So, anyway, what it's like now has been it's an incredible journey since I've gotten into Alcoholics Anonymous. I came in at the age of 42, an old guy. Seems like a lot of guys come in the 40s for some reason. And when I came into the program, I came in as a result of Vietnam, filled with hate, with bitterness, with rage. I hated myself and I hated everybody else, and I was told that I was a time bomb waiting to go off, and I didn't know it. And thank God, the grace of God, you know, kept me alive until I could get to this incredible program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was also terrified of finding out who I was. You know, I came to realize I was going to have to do work on me. I was going to have to start finding out about Tom, and I was terrified of what that picture was going to look like, and I knew it wouldn't be pretty, but... You know, I continue to come back. And today, as a result of being in Alcoholics Anonymous and being in it, not hanging around the outside of it and the outskirts of it whenever it's convenient, I love myself, and I can't do anything for you unless I love myself. You know, I can't care much about you if I don't have some sort of good feeling about myself, and I do today. And I care very much about other people in and out of this program. And it's very important to me, and I thank God for that every day, that change has come about. I got a sponsor right away. I was afraid of this guy. He was a construction guy, a hard ass. And, you know, and he told me that I needed to do certain things or I was going to drink. And nothing about suggestions. And I, you know, it's okay if you like the suggestion routine. But I'm a con artist and manipulator. I'll go right around a suggestion, however well-meaning it might be. I needed somebody to go mano a mano, eyeball to eyeball, and tell me these are the basic things you need to do, or you will not stay sober. And if for some reason I took to that, and not everybody does. I fully understand that. And then he said, I'm a very sensitive alcoholic. I'm sure you're not, but I am. And he said, Tom, if you're not willing to do these certain basic things, then don't waste your time and don't waste mine. And I thought to myself, how can you talk to me like that? I'm sensitive. And You know, but that's exactly what I do today with the guys I sponsor, you know, because these things have worked for me. And, you know, and it's helped a lot of guys, and each time I work with somebody, it helps me. And, you know, and he told me the things that I needed to do, the few basic things, is get a home group. Well, I had a home group the first meeting I ever went to. Still my home group. He said, get a step study. And I've been in step study since virtually the beginning of my program. You know, he said, go to one meeting a week where he's also there. You know, so there's something different about talking to somebody on the phone and being in a meeting with your sponsor where he can look eyeball to eyeball and check the tone of your voice and check these other things to see if what's being said over the phone matches, you know, with what he's seeing in the meeting. And he also told me to read the big book and to pick up that 1,000-pound phone and to call. And by the way, you need to call me. He doesn't need to call you. And I thought, well, that's not very nice. And, you know, and to go to a minimum of 3 meetings and don't cheat on the minimum. And and if you need more than that, go to more. And I believe that very strongly for me. I go to more than 3 meetings a week to this day. But those are the things that kind of the basics, you know, that I have learned. And I take these to heart and have since I've been in the program. I came to find a higher power that I could do business with. Doesn't have to be yours. Yours doesn't have to be mine. And, you know, my God is taking every step with me each and every day, and for that I'm very grateful. My God today is a caring and loving and a forgiving God, not a punishing, vengeful, hateful, or a condemning God. And and that's unbelievable. That is about as good as it gets. And and I'm grateful that our program is a spiritual program and not a religious program. I was told that religion is man-made and spirituality is God-given. And because I used to be a church-type guy, and nothing against that. But the spiritual part of it is what's clicked for me, and it's clicked for a lot of people in this fellowship. I've worked the steps several times with my sponsors, and the results over time have been dramatic. You know, I've been able to make peace with myself and with God. And somebody was talking about being honest, open-minded, and willing, and I've been able to get that way by working with sponsors and changing to be the person that God wants me to be, and that's who I am today. I believe in going through these steps, not just going through a cycle and then stopping and coming back 10 years later because maybe somebody mentioned a step, you know. But I have a forgetter. I need to recycle to keep it in my mind and keep it in my actions. Otherwise, I forget. And I started sponsoring men and have ever since. You know, it's neat to see the light come on like it did for me. You know, when they start working the steps and seeing themselves change and grow, it's an awesome feeling to see that. And I see it with the ladies that Ingeborg works with. It's great. Started to do service commitments. I think that's super important to jump into this program with both feet. Don't hang around the outsides. You know, make that horrible coffee in the beginning. And set up and tear down chairs and tables. And there used to be cigarette butt cans. I guess there still are in some meetings. You know, secretary, leader, greeter, GSR, you know, coordinating council rep, all those things I've done at some point in my sobriety and still do. 6 years of marriage, I married my incredible wife. You heard a little bit about our kind of unusual past. But we are blessed to be married over 18 years. And, you know, you probably have heard this saying, you know, don't be an Indian giver, but I believe in it. You know, I was able to give this woman away and take her back. So, so it is a bit unusual, I must say. But we have been blessed, the two of us, to have over 48 years of sobriety in our home. My wife has 4 months more of sobriety than I do, and I hope she always will have 4 months than I do. And I'm very, very proud of her, and I'm happy for my progress also. I also go to Camp Barrett once a month. I've been doing H&I work for over 18 years, going up there, and now it's a youth camp. All these macho kids, you know, all these gangbangers and people that think they're invincible, except they know better. there and take a panel and try and plant seeds. I think that's all that we're all trying to do is plant seeds wherever we go. Try and be a little bit better person each day. And maybe these kids will at some point say, yeah, I remember when those old guys came up to camp and they said something that all of a sudden took root. And, you know, it's very important that we do that. You know, Ingeborg and I have built an incredible relationship in our marriage because we've worked hard, very, very hard on our marriage. Didn't come easy. And at 17 years of sobriety, I had a spike of rage come up at home. And I was told by my wife that this is some more of that Vietnam stuff. And she was right. And I knew it. And I needed more help, and I reached out for that help. I went to my men's meeting, and I shared in a general way what was going on. And this guy was like another angel from God, as I understand him, said, you know, I had the same problem, and this is where I went. I went to the vet center and got the help. And so I've been going there, terrified of going into therapy, but I did it. And it was because of this program that gave me the courage and the strength to get the help. I have delayed PTSD over 30 years after the fact. But it's like now I have another support group. And many of the people in that support group are in Alcoholics Anonymous also. So it's an amazing world that I live in. And the book talks about there may come a time when we might have to seek outside help. And some people will say, well, all we need is the first 164 pages of the book. I necessarily believe that. There comes times when we need to seek outside help. And if you have those problems, I encourage you to get out there and get that help. I'll try and wrap it up here. And in conclusion, I'm very enthusiastic about my recovery. And I hope I stay that way and it'll help me to stay sober another day. It's like an insurance policy. You know, you pay the premiums and the policy won't lapse. And if you don't, then you're going to drink, you know. And to the newcomers, once again, if I can make it in this program, you can make it in this program. Reach out for help. Ask for help. You know, listen to what other people say. Have a little bit of faith and trust that they're telling you the truth and they're trying to help you. And you're in for one hell of a ride. Thank you for allowing us to share.